Matthew, chapter 12, verses 1 to 14. The 53rd talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on February 24, 2019, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2019. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we are continuing on in the Gospel of Matthew. Today we're in chapter 12. I've been saying that in this section that we have been seeing a lot about the response of the Jewish people to Jesus, largely negative. It kind of started out from chapter 10 when Jesus sent out the disciples and warned them that they might face a lot of opposition from those who would not like them because they didn't like where Jesus was coming from. And then as we went into chapter 11, we saw him pronouncing the woes on the cities in the Galilean region that had seen all his miracles and yet didn't repent. We even saw John the Baptist being confused in his response as to how to deal with Jesus. So that sort of theme continues on in chapter 12. I'm going to read to you the part that we're going to look at today. As you will tell immediately, this section is about the Sabbath. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on a Sabbath." But he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not a sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Departing from there, he went into their synagogue, and a man was there whose hand was withered, and they questioned Jesus, asking, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" So that they might accuse him. And he said to them, "What man is there among you who has a sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will he not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable then is a man than a sheep? So then, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and it was restored to normal like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him as to how they might destroy him. Okay, so this is the one place in Matthew where the issue of the Sabbath is addressed. It's a very important issue. It plays a large part in Jesus' relationship with the Pharisees. It's a very big deal to them. We see other examples in the Gospel of John, a number of places where the Sabbath becomes an issue, Jesus healing on the Sabbath, and so on. It's interesting that here's the only place where Matthew addresses it. The Sabbath, of course, played a large role in the religious life of the Jews. And, of course, the Pharisees are the champions of the law, as they understand it. So this is an issue that is very important to them. Notice at the end, because of the way Jesus is handling these Sabbath things, the Pharisees are planning to destroy him, all because of the way he has healed on the Sabbath, and also probably this other situation where the disciples are going through the grain field. That may seem sort of extreme to us. I mean, it is obviously an extreme reaction, but it shows how significant it was to them. And I think by the time we're done, we can see that it's not necessarily wrong to see the Sabbath as a significant issue, but it's how you see it as significant and what you do with it. It's interesting, the Gospel of John tells a similar story where here I think we're talking about Pharisees in the region of Galilee, where Jesus is hanging out at this point. In John, it's the leaders in Jerusalem who react to Jesus healing a man who is lame on the Sabbath. And once again, the response is that they want to kill him. So very striking and very important in this section where we're looking at the relationship between Jesus and the Jews and the Jewish leadership and how they are responding to him. This is a particularly significant aspect of that relationship. Okay, I want to start with, since I am a Gentile and most of us here are Gentiles, I think, I have decided to start with my idiot's guide to the Sabbath, which is to try to look back a little bit and figure out what is the deal with the Sabbath stuff. Because if we don't, it's easy to think about some of the more extremely strange aspects of the way ultimately the rabbis formulated laws, and they're rightly, we can rightly look at those as strange, but there's something fundamental at the foundation of this that we want to understand, I think. The Sabbath was established, we first see it established in the Mosaic Law in Exodus 31:12. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, "But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel saying, you shall surely observe my Sabbaths," which is my rests, that's the word. "For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore, you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he ceased from labor and was refreshed." Okay, so what do we learn here? It is a sign between God and Israel. It is an important signifier of this unique relationship that God has with Israel. "It is so that they might know that Yahweh is the one who sanctifies them, who sets them apart. He has given Israel this unique position in relationship to himself. He will be their God, they will be his people, and this is true of them in a way that it's not true of anyone else. And the Sabbath is a sign of that unique relationship and a reminder to them that God has indeed sanctified them in this way. There is a death penalty if you do any work on the Sabbath. This should immediately tell us that there is something significant going on here. This is a serious deal because the law that Moses sets out is saying that you will be killed if you violate the Sabbath. And it points back to the seventh day of creation. You may remember that in Genesis 2, at the end of the account of the 6 days where God creates everything, on the seventh day it says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts. By the seventh day God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made." So, I mean, right at the very account of the creation of the world, we are being prepared for the significance of the Sabbath, that God has sanctified that day as the day when he rested from the work of making the world and made it a unique and holy set-apart sort of day. And now in his covenant with Israel, he is asking them to do this religious practice which sets apart that seventh day for something in particular. So what sorts of things are they not supposed to do? They're not supposed to work. They're supposed to rest. But there are not many specifics in the law about what that would look like. I can imagine that if they were serious in enacting a death penalty for not doing it, you might want to do a little thinking about what is and is not acceptable, because the stakes are high. They're told not to kindle a fire in their dwelling. That's one of the things that they're told. They're told that they must keep the Sabbath even during plowing time and harvest. So there's a time where there's some serious work that needs to be done, work to make sure that there's going to be food to eat, and yet you're supposed to keep the Sabbath then. So on the Sabbath day, you should not be out there plowing or harvesting. There is a story that's told about a man who gathers wood on the Sabbath, and people see him and they bring him to Moses, and Moses tells them to stone him to death, which they do. So gathering wood on the Sabbath seems to have been understood as a violation. But like I say, otherwise we don't have a lot of specifics about what constitutes work and that sort of thing. The general idea, I think the spirit behind it, is expressed in Isaiah 58. So here we have Isaiah. Okay, this is much later, right? I mean, this is the time when Isaiah is looking at the Babylonian captivity, the idea that there is a serious judgment coming from God if they don't take God seriously. Here he's talking about how if they do take God seriously, and his description is, if because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord, honorable, and honor it, desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure, and speaking your own word, then you will take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth, and I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. So they are to honor it, take it seriously as something that God has asked them to do, and to honor it the way you submit to the spirit of what it is that God is asking is you desist from your own stuff. You desist from your own ways, your own pleasure, your own word. This is not the day where I'm calling the shots, I'm getting what I want, I'm doing what I think needs to be done. This is the day when I am stopping and looking to God, thinking about God, not working as he has asked, and furthermore, taking my spirit and submitting myself to God, taking that relationship very seriously. There is also the related concept of the land having Sabbath years, which I bring up because it is significant in this story. I don't exactly I'm not enough of a farmer. I'm not any sort of farmer. I could go on for how much I don't know about plants and all of that stuff. But there is this, God asked them every seventh year to not harvest and plant. They basically just let stuff go. If they need something to eat, they can go out and pick it off of what's out there. But they're not going to be harvesting, so storing up crops for themselves, and they're not going to be replanting so that there will be new stuff the next year. So in, I think this is Leviticus, but if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops, then I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that it will bring forth the crop for 3 years. When you are sowing the eighth year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the ninth year when its crop comes in. So it reminds us a little bit of what happened when they were in the wilderness with the manna, where they were asked not to gather the manna on the Sabbath. It takes a little bit of trust in God that on the sixth day, the stuff is not going to rot the way it was on the other days. Well, here, God is saying, the stuff that you gather before the seventh year, I will make sure that you have enough so that it'll last all the way through this time of not planting and then replanting and so on. Okay, so that's the sort of stuff we saw with the Sabbath. God promises judgment ultimately on the nation if they do not take seriously his Sabbaths. Even when he gave the Sabbath laws, like the land Sabbath that I was describing, where every 7 years they were supposed to let it lie fallow, after that was described, God says, if you guys don't take me seriously, if you are not keeping my covenant and doing the things I asked, I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled over it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations and will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it will observe the rest, which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living in it. So you can see the idea is there's a fair amount of incentive for people not to take seriously that seventh year thing. I mean, that could be quite devastating if it doesn't work out right. And I don't know, we don't know a lot, but there isn't much evidence that they actually did take that seven-year Sabbath thing very seriously, that happened very much. So he's saying, okay, well, there's one way that God can ensure that the land gets its rest. If you don't get it, I'm just going to bring in your enemies, cart you off, then the land will get plenty of rest because you won't be there. Jeremiah said, but if you do not listen to me to keep the Sabbath day holy by not carrying a load and coming in through the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then I will kindle a fire in its gates, and it will devour the palaces of Jerusalem and not be quenched. And Isaiah and Ezekiel said similar things. You know, there's a lot of language about judgment for oppressing the poor and a lack of justice and all sorts of things, but there is also language of judgment on them for not keeping either the seven-year land Sabbath or the weekly Sabbath. Judgment is going to come upon them if they don't take it seriously. Second Chronicles looks back on the Babylonian captivity after it's all over. It says, then they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its fortified buildings with fire and destroyed all its valuable articles. This is what the Babylonians are doing to Jerusalem. Those who had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. So that thing that had been promised in Leviticus, that came to pass. And in Chronicles, they're describing as that, see, this is where the land is getting the Sabbaths that it wasn't given. I think this is a very telling little story. After they come back from Babylon, after they have been given permission by the Persians to go back into the land and rebuild the walls and so on, so Nehemiah writes, this is Nehemiah speaking in Nehemiah 13, in those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads, and they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. Also men of Tyre were living there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this evil thing you are doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city all this trouble? yet you are adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. It came about that just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and that they should not open them until after the Sabbath. Then I stationed some of my servants at the gates so that no load would enter on the Sabbath day. Once or twice the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside Jerusalem. Then I warned them and said to them, "Why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you." From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath, and I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. So this is serious. I mean, Nehemiah is saying, here you guys go again. Don't you remember what happened to us the last time we didn't take God seriously? And what is it that they're doing? Why aren't they, I mean, what's the problem with taking a little vacation on Saturday? I mean, that seems like a decent thing to do, right? Saturday's here. We get to rest for a little bit. But the thing is that you're not, in this situation, they're not doing commerce. There are people there who want to trade with them. They've got their goods and their crops and so on, and they want to take them into Jerusalem so that they can sell them to people and they can get what they need. They want the Sabbath to be a regular day of commerce. In other words, they want to work because it's going to cost them if they don't do that. So it's, once again, losing sight of who it is that they're really trusting in and saying, look, I'd be an idiot not to be working on the Sabbath because I'm going to be losing out. In the light of all of this stuff, here's what I would see about the Sabbath right now, and I'm still trying to understand. I may be missing some things or may not be getting this right, but what was it about? It was about refreshment. There was an element of rest, as in resting from your work, which is a good thing, a revitalizing thing. But there is this concept of rest, I think, that they're being invited to contemplate because of the connection that is made to the 7 days of creation, that God worked and then finished his creation and rested on the seventh day. This idea that God has something that he is doing and he sees it through and then he rests. I think it's interesting, I mean, we can see this from the book of Hebrews, reminds us of this stuff. But if you go back in the Old Testament, the promised land is described as a rest that God is giving them. So we have another, again, a picture of they're in slavery, they're going through the wilderness. I mean, there is all this work which culminates in God bringing them to the place of rest, living in the land and having milk and honey and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So again, there is this picture of a work that God is doing that culminates in a rest, which again is for the benefit of his creation. And then, we pick this up from Hebrews that later, as we go along and more information comes to us through the prophets and the Psalms and so on, that there are hints of a further rest, that God is doing this work and there is still this rest that remains to happen in the world as we know it now. And that comes, we come to see that as the messianic kingdom and so on. So this idea that we are resting from our work in recognition of the fact that God rested from his work and that he has made a commitment to the people of Israel to sanctify them, to make them holy to himself, to be their God and so on. This is the time when that symbolism of the work is done and now we're resting is applied to God and we think about our relationship to God. That's why it's significant that there is a certain cost to the Sabbath, that if you stop working, then you're not getting the benefits of the work that you're doing. We live in a cursed world where we're working by the sweat of our brow, and it ultimately ends in death. We are working to stave off death, right? We're trying to make sure that we can keep ourselves alive. And for most people, for many of the people of Israel, that's exactly the way life would have been. You got to keep working to make sure that you keep breathing, that you keep going. Notice that when we see the examples of people not keeping the Sabbath, it's precisely because they're afraid of the cost. They're afraid that they're going to lose out if they're not continually working to make sure that they provide for themselves. And so it's an opportunity that in thinking about God having called us to this rest, we are actively trusting God. We're looking at the fact that God has made this commitment that ultimately he is going to bring the people of Israel into their blessing, and that's what we're relying on, and that's why we can rest on this day. And if we don't, it's probably because we don't take God all that seriously and think, I've got to make sure that I take care of myself. So the Sabbath was a serious thing. God took it seriously. He had that death penalty if you didn't keep it. And I mean, there's a long discussion there. When we think about the death penalty in Israel under the covenant that they made there, it's not like the way that we would set up a law that if we have a death penalty, it's sort of this, well, if you kill somebody, then you've forfeited your own life or something like that. This is the unique sanctified position of the people of Israel before God, that God was saying, I have entered into this relationship, I have made this promise that I am going to take care of you, bless you in the land, and so on, but this covenant we have made requires you to take me seriously, to enter into the terms of the covenant that I have made, which means obeying what I have asked you to obey. And so if you have so little confidence in me that you can't bring yourself to stop trying to take care of yourself on that day, then there's something seriously wrong and you need to be, the land needs to be purged of you because we're going for something unique here. So it's not, if you're wondering, I am not currently advocating the death penalty for not keeping the Sabbath. If I ever run for office, I will make that abundantly clear as part of my campaign. But it shows that the attitude, that fundamental attitude of this is something that God has called us to do and there are good reasons for me to submit to this, that whether you had that attitude or not was really important. And the history of Israel, as the Pharisees would look back on the history of Israel, God destroyed Jerusalem and brought the Babylonians upon them in part because they didn't take the Sabbath seriously. And the Pharisees, as I understand it, arose as a party after the time of, in the period of time between when they came back into the land and when the time of Jesus, because they wanted to emphasize, look, we as a people have not been obedient. We didn't take the law seriously. Well, that's going to end. We are the party that is going to say, we are about the law. We're going to take it seriously. So I think we can understand then why, in principle, they would be upset about a religious leader who comes along and seems to not be taking the Sabbath seriously. So that's the context in which we find the things that we're talking about here now. There are two stories. The first story is about the disciples going through the grain field. The second one is about healing the man with the withered hand on the Sabbath. Okay, yeah. Let me read the first couple of verses here to get us started. Matthew 12:1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on a Sabbath. It's hard to know exactly what the situation of the disciples is at this time. They're following Jesus. They're likely not near home. They are following him wherever it is, the next thing that he's going to do, and they're hungry, and so they reach out and they rub the grain between their hands and take the edible part and eat it. The Pharisees say, look, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. And the interesting thing about this section is we can ask the question, are the Pharisees right about this? Have they rightly understood what the requirement not to work on the Sabbath requires? I suspect that most of us would say that seems like they have probably gone too far. We're all aware of that concept that the Pharisees did what they called putting a hedge around the law, where you make sure that you don't get even close to doing something that might be construed as breaking the law. And this really seems like that, and it probably is something like that. What's interesting, though, is that that's not the tack that Jesus takes in coming at it, at least not at first. It seems like he's sort of granting them their premise, because they say, your disciples do what is not lawful to do. And then the first story he tells is about David who ate what was not lawful for him to eat. So it seems like he's sort of granting them their premise. All right, let's take it on your terms. They're doing something that is not lawful according to the Sabbath. Seems like that. It seems like that's the situation. Okay, now we're going to see four unique kind of statements that Jesus is going to make as we go through here in defense of his point. Each one of them, I have questions as to exactly what he's saying. It seems to me that there's kind of two ways that we could go with this. And hopefully I'll make that clear as we go through. I am your humble servant up here, right? I am the sort of person that would much, much rather get up here and give you a talk about what I have confidently decided is going on in these passages. But all I can do is tell you, as far as I can figure it out so far, I'm kind of leaning in this direction. And I hope that I can clarify some things, but I am saying to you that I could imagine that I might come back sometime and say, you know, I changed my mind. It's actually, I think it's over on the other side now. In fact, in what I'm about to say, he refers to a passage in here that this is the second time that he refers to this Old Testament passage. And last time I talked about it, I said I'm leaning in one direction on what's going on there. And I think this time, we'll see, by the time I get there, I'm still thinking about it. But I think this time I'm going to say I'm kind of leaning in the other direction now. Here's the deal. The first thing he says to them, have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. Okay, so it seems to me that it has always seemed to me that there are kind of two ways you can go with this first statement. And actually, I think there are kind of two ways you can go with all of the statements that he makes. Option one, David's story is an example of how human need trumps ritual law. David and his companions were hungry, it says. And so here are these hungry people. Are we going to let the ritual requirements of the law that only the priests are supposed to eat this bread, are we going to let that stop us from feeding these men who are hungry? No, we're not. Jesus could be arguing that. He could be arguing that compassion and mercy towards someone in need trumps the ritual requirement of the law. That is, in fact, what he's going to argue in the next story. He's going to make this argument for how, look, and his conclusion is going to be, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. So we'll see that when we get there. That may be what he's doing here. But it has always struck me that there is another option for how to take this. David's story shows Jesus' unique position as the Messiah, the Davidic king, descended from David. So we're aware that the New Testament often refers to Psalms of David or events in David's life and draws a connection with Jesus because Jesus is that final Davidic king who represents completely what it is the throne of David has always meant ultimately to be for Israel. So things that are true, you know, I think we find places where things that are true about the David or about Solomon or something like that are applied to Jesus because there is this similarity or this identity between the kind of situation that you find yourself in. So, is that what's going on here? It is interesting that we have Jesus and his companions here, and Jesus tells a story about David and his companions as they go to the temple. If we're thinking about, is this story about compassion for those who are hungry, trumping the ritual requirements? It could be. I do wonder, I mean, we can't know for sure, but I do wonder whether the priest would have given the bread to anybody who came by, that if there was somebody came by that was hungry, would he have given them the bread? It's possible. But the fact is, this was David. David Crabtree points to something interesting about this story. I don't know if he still thinks this is interesting, but years ago, in this thing, in the story about David, remember, he's on the run, David, the soon-to-be king in the story, from King Saul, who wants to kill him, or he's afraid that he wants to kill him. He needs food and a way to protect himself. And when he goes to the priest in this situation, he asks him for food, and he asks him for a weapon. And what he ends up with is the sanctified bread that only the priests were supposed to eat and the sword of Goliath, the one that he had conquered. So it's always hard in the Old Testament, more often than not, the activity and purposes of God are not described, if you know what I mean. I mean, something happens and we're left asking the question, are we supposed to be thinking that this is something that God wanted to happen in this way and that there's something significant about the fact that it did? So it's possible, as we look at this story, with David ending up with the sanctified bread and the sword of Goliath in response to his requests, we could see the story as implying that God has providentially provided unique food and protection for David as the anointed king to be. So here's David, he's on the run. He doesn't have very many places to go because, you know, everywhere out there is dangerous. The king's got his people everywhere. And he's on the run and he goes and he ends up sort of unexpectedly with the showbread and the sword of Goliath. If you read the story in that way, and maybe that is not the way to read the story, I recognize I may be going too far with it, but if you read it in that way, then the story kind of gives us a little picture of God's values in this, in that his protection of David as the anointed king to come has, his values have made it so that he has privileged taking care of David over keeping the rules about the showbread. So Jesus could be saying something like, if I grant your premise that it is unlawful to eat this wheat or grain or corn or whatever it is, the fact is that I am the Messiah of God and these disciples are supporting themselves in pursuit of my work. And that's significant. Okay, now I'll talk about that more as we go along. But hopefully you see the two kinds of ways you could go. Is the lesson of this primarily about merciful provision for people in need, or is the lesson of this primarily about recognizing the unique place of Jesus as the Messiah? Next argument. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. Okay, now the example is clear enough by itself, the first statement. On the Sabbath, the priests in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent. It is clearly true that God has a hierarchy of values. It is not true that the Sabbath in and of itself is some sort of an absolute that must be preserved by the very nature of things or somehow. The fact is that the same God who said, don't work on the Sabbath, said to the priests, work on the Sabbath. So clearly there are situations where we can see that for God there is something of higher value that supersedes whatever the value was of the Sabbath regulation. So that's clear enough, however you take it. I think that seems right. But what does Jesus mean by something greater than the temple is here? Well, it depends on which of those two kind of forks in the road you take. I'm sure it's even more complicated than this, but let me simplify it by talking about two forks. Option one, the greater thing than the temple is mercifully providing food for people in need. So what's greater than the temple is the moral values of God in being merciful and compassionate and like that. So his argument would be that the priests in the temple are obviously doing something that's more important than keeping the Sabbath rules, but mercifully providing food for those in need is more important than what the priests are doing in the temple. So that's the thing that's greater than the temple. So that means that mercifully providing food is even more important than the Sabbath. Priests trump Sabbath, mercy trumps priests, so mercy trumps Sabbath. That would be the nature of the argument. Option two, the thing that is greater than the temple that is here is Jesus, the Messiah, as Messiah. He is greater than the temple. If the temple work is more important than the Sabbath, the Messiah's work is even more important. And the disciples of Jesus are feeding themselves, getting the stuff from the grain, while they are following Jesus in his work. Third argument. But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not a sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. Okay, so I'm sorry for that. This is complicated. I'm sorry that it's also complicated, but I didn't write it. So this is the second time that this passage is quoted in Matthew. It's from Hosea 6:6. The first time was in chapter 9, verse 13. When I talked about that passage at that time, I was asking questions about this word translated compassion. It's in the Hebrew, it's the Hebrew word chesed. The Greek word that the Septuagint, Hebrew has this word chesed, which we'll talk about in a minute. There is a Greek translation of the Hebrew from several hundred years before the time of Jesus, and they use a word that means mercy or compassion. And that's the word that is used in the Greek text that we have here. So that's what we're working with. When you look at this word chesed, as I tried to look at it and think about what was going on there, if we talk about God, who is usually the one who has chesed, God is described all the time as his chesed. It emphasizes the kind of the steadfast, committed loyalty of God. Sometimes they translate it covenant loyalty. The idea is that God has made this commitment to the people of Israel, and he is reliable. He will come through with what it is that he promised. But there's also an element to the word. It's coming through in a compassionate, good, beneficial way. So it is God's merciful compassion that he is steadfastly committed to bringing about. You know, that all of that stuff is kind of wrapped up in it. Now, when we talk about human beings having chesed, though, when that's what we're talking about here, what is involved with that? It's a little different at times. Between people, like if one person is showing chesed to another, it kind of has that similar sort of, I am playing straight with you and I am treating you well. I'm not stabbing you in the back. I am sort of straightforwardly, faithfully treating you well. And I'm expecting you to do the same for me. Something like that. And sometimes the emphasis of the word is on the idea of being merciful, of showing compassion and treating the other person well. And in those situations, that's where the Greek word that means compassion or mercy is often used to translate it. Now, having chesed towards God, I think, if I'm following what's going on, it's describing more the idea of faithfulness and steadfast commitment to God. Having chesed towards God means I am hanging in there with him. I want to know his ways. I want to follow what it is that he's doing and that sort of thing. So, what do we have in our passage? Last time I was looking at this, I was arguing that it seemed to me, as I looked at the Old Testament and the words and going back and forth, in this Hosea passage, that the argument is that the translation, compassion for the in that situation, represented what it was that was being argued. What God was saying is, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. And that's what I was saying I was leaning toward the last time. And I don't remember the details, but I remember, I'm pointing back there where Ryan was sitting, where Ryan is always sitting and asking those questions. And Ryan made the argument back, well, okay, so, but looking at Hosea, don't you think it could be that other sense of faithfulness towards God and that sort of thing? And I said, yeah, I can see that, but right now I'm leaning the other way. Okay, so now where am I? Now where am I leaning? I'm sort of leaning back the other way now. So one way of translating it would be, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. And if that's what the passage means, then the sort of thing that Jesus would be saying would be fairly straightforward. The Pharisees should be valuing compassion, as in compassion for the disciples who are hungry in the situation, over Sabbath observance. That's the sort of lesson that ought to be drawn. But the other possibility for how it ought to be translated, or closer to how it ought to be translated, is something like, I desire true faithfulness to God over sacrifice. That is, sacrifice represents this superficial sort of, yeah, it looks like you're about God, but what I'm interested in is actual faithful commitment, desire to know God and follow what he wants for you and that kind of thing. And that is the way it would be translated. What would that mean then in our passage? Well, I think that could support either one of the options that I've been talking about. If the Pharisees should value faithfulness to God and his ways, which that could mean then, if you understand God, you know how God would put a higher priority over being compassionate and making sure that they were fed when they're hungry over ritual or a law like the Sabbath. So if you had understood what God wanted from you, then you would have been looking for what God's values are in this situation. So the word doesn't mean compassion, but that faithfulness would mean that you would try to figure out what God wanted, and of course, what he wants is compassion. But the other option, seems to me, is we could picture the disciples as being those who are showing their faithfulness, their true desire to know God, in that they are following Jesus. And so He's saying, if you had recognized that what God wants is, he's interested in a true heart that is committed to God and following his way, as opposed to mere sacrifice, then you would not have condemned the innocent. That is, you would look at the disciples and say, here are people following the Messiah, showing their desire to know God and understand his way and so on. And so they're being in a situation where they haven't provided for themselves on the Sabbath, so they have to pick this stuff as they're going along. That's the more valuable thing than having actually kept the rule as you Pharisees see. I don't know if that's clear. I hope that's clear. I'm trying to be as clear as I can as to how I'm thinking about this. I'm sorting it out myself. Okay, but those are the two options. Again, we basically have the option of, is the value involved here fundamentally one of feeding the disciples mercifully is more important than the Sabbath? Or is it the disciples' commitment to following Jesus the Messiah is what's more important than the Sabbath? The last argument is, the last thing he says is, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And oh, this is a tricky little thing. I have found myself, what I tried to do this time is to think about Mark's version. We have a version of this event, this account, in all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And each of them is different than the other. Each has certain things that the other two don't. actually, is that true? Does Luke have anything that... Luke may not have anything that the other two don't. But Mark has something that neither Matthew and Luke have, and Matthew has something that neither Mark or Luke have. Here's what Mark has. He says, Jesus said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath, so the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. So he's actually giving a kind of a, since this is true, so then it follows that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And his statement is, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. And he seems to be saying, so it follows then that the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Okay, if that's the argument, then what does that mean? What is he saying? This is my... You know, I've been hammering on this passage all weekend while I have been hacking, coughing, and dizzy. So this is my warning that maybe I'm just not making any sense, but I've just been trying to sort of sort this out. So what's going on with that Mark passage? I found myself thinking about this idea that something is made for man and man is not made for it. And what I'm thinking right now is what he's distinguishing for, that what he's talking about is in relationship to the law in particular, and distinguishing whether a law is sort of fundamental and morally necessary, or it is provisional in some way, something that is intended to benefit or teach man in some way. So the commandment to love God, if I'm taking this right, That doesn't qualify the way Jesus said that here. Man is made for the commandment to love God, and the commandment is not made for him. That is a fundamental, that is not going to change. Man has to adapt himself to that, because that's a fundamental truth about God and his values and what things are about. But perhaps what he's saying is that the Sabbath is not a thing like that. The Sabbath, this law that God gave that you have to keep the Sabbath, it was made for man. It was made for man's benefit and education. It does provide refreshment, so there is a certain value to it. But even more, it provides thought-provoking instruction. It provides an opportunity to obey and trust God. It is this rich situation that God has created as an environment in which the Jews can think about what God means to them and what their hope is and the final end of things and all of that stuff. That's what the Sabbath is. It's a thing that was made for man. In other words, it could have been different. It's there intended something that is pliable because it was made for this certain purpose to benefit man. Well, Jesus is the Son of Man. That is, he is the human being who is the Messiah. And as such, he both represents man to God and represents God to man. He is the perfect man who lives the life of obedience before God that mankind should, and he is the perfect representation of God. He represents God to us. He tells us who God is. He shows us who God is. He tells us what God wants, and so on. He shows us God's truth, God's values, God's desires, God's character. Therefore, he is exactly positioned because the Sabbath was made for man. It is something, it is not a moral given that we must submit to, but is something that God created for the benefit of man. Therefore, Jesus, the Son of Man, the one who is the man who stands between God and mankind, he is exactly positioned to be the Lord even of the Sabbath. Even this thing that God gave to Israel that seems like this fundamental law, you're going to die if you don't keep it. Jesus, as the man who shows God to us and lives as man ought to live before God, he is the one who is best positioned to show and explain what it is about, how it ought to be lived, what it would really look like in the world, and so on. So the Messiah would not be free. Jesus does not have the authority to come along and say, God has given me authority, so therefore you don't have to love God anymore. I'm taking that law out. He couldn't do that. But he does have the authority to come along and say, this is what the Sabbath is about, and here's what it would look like to be a person who cares what the Sabbath is about in this situation. So for the Pharisees then, if I'm right in the direction that I'm going with this stuff, and I recognize I'm right, kind of on the edge trying to sort this out. But if we see the focus as being on Jesus' messiahship, then the Pharisees have looked at this and they've said, look, these guys are not following the rules as we understand them in relationship to the Sabbath. Therefore, we reject. We're not going to listen to what this guy has to say. Whereas, in fact, they ought to be turning it the other way around. This is, in fact, the Messiah, and therefore, he is the one who is best positioned to show us what it is that the Sabbath is about and how we ought to be taking it seriously. So I am leaning in the direction of seeing the focus of this passage as being on Jesus' unique role as Messiah. The disciples are rubbing the grain because following Jesus has led them into this situation. They are faithfully committed to the values of God, following his Messiah, and so their behavior on the Sabbath should be evaluated in that light. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus is saying, hey, I can do what I want. I'm the Messiah. I'm the boss. So if I want to work, I can work. Or if my disciples want to work, they can work. That's not what I'm saying. But he would be reminding them that the Sabbath law should be understood in the context of God's ultimate values and goals. The disciples have chosen the right path in following Jesus, and so meeting their physical needs on the road rightly takes precedence over a rigid avoidance of what might technically be called work. And Jesus is the one who has the authority to show the Pharisees and the world, this is what the Sabbath would actually be about. I am the one who can take this law and say, here's how we're going to do it. Here's how it ought to be lived out in this situation. Let me just say then real briefly about the next story. I think it's fairly obvious what's happening here. They're testing Jesus. They want to know, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? They see this guy's got a withered hand. Let's see if he gets himself in trouble. Let's see what he says to this. And at the end, Jesus' answer is, yes, it is lawful to heal on the Sabbath because it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Just because it's work to help somebody, that doesn't mean that you're not supposed to do it on the Sabbath. That doesn't mean that the Sabbath has prohibited it. And he argues pretty basically, you know, this really shouldn't be that hard for you guys. If your sheep gets stuck in a pit, you go and take it out on the Sabbath. I mean, of course, you just do because it makes sense. So who's more important, a man or a sheep? So, you know, the conclusion is, everyone, yes, yes, you can. But Jesus then does the miracle of healing the man with the withered hand, but for the Pharisees, their commitment to their particular understanding of the Sabbath is so strong that they don't see the miracle as evidence that this is the Messiah and they had better turn to him so that he can help them understand what God wants. They see it as evidence that he is obviously someone that needs to be gotten rid of because he's violating the Sabbath according to the way that we would see it. So the miracle itself doesn't really mean anything to them. It's the fact that he would do it on the Sabbath. We're not going to have time for questions, I'm sorry. Let me just finish with a couple of comments and then we'll have to end, and I'll try to make sure that we have room for them next time. This passage has always been significant to me as a side sort of issue because of this is the place where Jesus says, and there are others, but have you not read this? The Pharisees are putting together their understanding of the Sabbath according to certain passages that are directly about the rules that you're supposed to follow on the Sabbath. But Jesus is saying, you know, in order to understand what God's values are all about that have led to this Sabbath, what it is that God would want, you can't just look at the command that you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. You also have to look at the story about David eating the showbread. I know that you're not a priest, so it never occurred to you to look at the rules for priests concerning the Sabbath, but think about the significance of what's happening, that God commanded the priest to work on the Sabbath. That must mean something, right? That has to enter into our... And Hosea is not talking about the Sabbath. He's talking about sacrifice. God is saying, I desire chesed, compassion, faithfulness, whatever it might be there. I desire that thing and not sacrifice. But you have to understand that in order to understand how to think about how God would look at a ritual requirement, a religious requirement like the Sabbath. So this is a hugely important model to us as readers of the Bible. If we take seriously that we would like to understand God better by reading this book, then this is kind of a slap on the wrist to those who would do the sort of the proof test texting kind of thing that would say, look, I got a verse that says this. No, it's not a verse. It's like, I am trying to understand the mind of God as he has revealed himself through what he has said and what he has done and what he has revealed through his prophets and how he treated Israel and all of that. So if we want to understand God, then we just have to be committed to that larger work of trying to put the larger context together. Jesus is saying to the Pharisees who saw themselves as the teachers of the law, haven't you read that book? Because you have to put the whole thing together. You can't just pull out these little things. The story itself shows, I may be wrong that the issue of Jesus' messiahship is what's at stake in the first story, but clearly we can see that Jesus' complaint in general is that God has a hierarchy of values and that there was a clear and serious purpose for the commandment concerning the Sabbath. And it would be wrong to be a person who did not take that seriously. To be an Israelite who did not take that seriously would be very wrong. But again, God has things that are more important to him. I always like the story about the Pharisee, the scribe, who asked Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, well, love God, love your neighbor as yourself. And then that Pharisee says, right. And you're right that loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself is much more important than sacrifice. And then Jesus says, well, you're not far from the kingdom of heaven. So that fundamental recognition that, yes, God has given laws and commandments, but there are his fundamental overarching values and principles, and then there are the ways that some of these other laws and commandments interact with those, teach us those or remind us those or whatever. But what you don't want to do is mistake the supplementary material for the fundamental issue. And finally, I just a reminder that part of the reason that setting out a set of rules for the Sabbath is attractive is if your primary interest is a kind of self-righteousness, if you would like to be able to convince yourself that you are in the right, that God ought to reward you because you have done the right thing, you have to know what the right thing is. And putting more value on loving compassion, sacrificial compassion for others and that sort of thing, that's a harder thing to do, actually, than not baking certain kinds of things on the Sabbath or something like that. If you can lay the rules out, it's easier to be able to say, I did it. So, as I have argued all along, I think self-righteousness is one of the fundamental critiques that Jesus has of the religious establishment at the time and the people who have listened to them, is that they think that somehow the law of God is intended to be this thing that allows me to feel good about myself. Okay, thanks.